I want to thank the previous speakers. They did a great job of setting up my presentation for me, because they've talked about Wendell's scientific contribution and his basically extension contributions. As an extension specialist, my job is to change behavior. That's what all good extension specialists do. And I just want to posit the theory that Wendell Gilliam, although he was 80% research and 20% teaching, probably had greater impact as an extension specialist than all of us extension specialists combined, because he was able to change behavior. Let me talk a little bit about how he did that. Now, I was told a story by Wendell. And for those of you that know Wendell, Wendell tells two kinds of stories. He tells regular stories, and he tells fishing stories, right? And so I don't know whether this is a regular story or a fishing story. And so I'm going to let you all determine which kind of story you think it is. He told me that when he was a whippersnapper young scientist at NC State, he started reading about the fact that agricultural was causing non-point source pollution, particularly chemical fertilizers. And he just didn't believe it. So he set out to prove that it was wrong. Now, we've already heard that Wendell admits when he was wrong. He takes chances. And so he did this experiment in the western part of the state. It was some bluegrass sod, I think. And he applied fertilizer, and he didn't apply fertilizer. And lo and behold, the fields that he applied fertilizer to had a higher runoff rate by about four times as much than the ones that didn't. And then it was at this point, Wendell, the light bulb went off, and he changed into the interface between ag and the environment. Now, any of you that have seen Wendell give a talk will have seen the next slide. But I want to talk about what Wendell thinks. And this is his conclusion. Riparian buffers are the single most important factor for controlling non-point source pollution in humid regions. Now, Wendell will say that it is not the only best management practice, that we shouldn't rely on riparian buffers alone, but if you had to pick one, it's like picking one of your kids, right? This is the one he'd pick. Now, a little bit about how he decided that riparian buffers were the most important BMP. He started sinking shallow groundwater wells, and when he sank them into cropland situations, and he looked at the nitrate-nitrogen concentration, it ranged from about 10 to 20 part per million nitrate-nitrogen from the ditch edge through the field. However, when he did the same thing in a riparian buffer that was adjacent to an agricultural field, he saw this decline in nitrate-nitrogen that many of the rest of you have shown in your research. And generally, this reduction in nitrate-nitrogen was about 95%. And it was this kind of data that led Wendell to his conclusion, along with some stream data. He had surface water data through open ditches that were not buffered. He had surface water data through natural streams that were buffered. And he saw about a 3 to 4-fold increase in the nitrate-nitrogen in the streams that were not buffered. So he recommended riparian buffers. Now, we've already had this relationship between Wendell, Lawrence, and Correll. Correll in Maryland, Lawrence, where are you? Is he here? There? Hello? In Georgia. They all produced research results about the same time independently. So you had this convergence of ideas through independent research. And Wendell went on to look at different physiographic regions, the effects of buffers in different physiographic regions, both in the coastal plain and Piedmont, and saw very similar kinds of results, this reduction in nitrate-nitrogen through the shallow groundwater. He was also interested, though, in reduction of pollutants through surface water flow. And he worked with John Parsons, who was in the Biological and Agricultural Engineering Department, who's now deceased. And they produced some work that has been produced in the Water Research Institute reports. And he looked at percent reduction in sediment through different buffer widths on the coastal plain. So this was a very fat, flat kind of situation. And he found that about an 80% reduction for 15 feet. You double that to 30 feet, but you only get about a 15% more reduction in your sediment load. Because we have many physiographic regions in North Carolina, he also needed to do this in the Piedmont. The slope here was about 5 to 6%. He saw, again, a good sediment reduction within the first 15 feet, not quite as good as the coastal plain, but the Piedmont did an excellent job also. Now, this slide is a little backwards of what I've been showing you. This is the phosphorus reduction through grass filter strips, and it's on the y-axis you have buffer P delivery ratio. That is, when there is no buffer, you have 100% of your phosphorus being delivered. When you have a buffer of about 15 feet, you actually have about 60% of your phosphorus being reduced. Now remember, in the other slides, Wendell showed 70 to 80% sediment reduction at 15 feet. These data are real similar to lots of other folks who have done these kind of studies in that sediment is reduced more than phosphorus. And he also looked at total Kaldall nitrogen from the field edge. In his grass buffers, it's the green and red line. He saw about a 60% reduction at about 15 feet. He had some forested buffers. That's the white line and the brownish line. And for the forested buffers, they weren't nearly as effective. He saw only about a 40% reduction, but at a much greater buffer width. And so based on this, he came to conclude that grass buffers were really effective for surface reductions of non-point source pollution, whereas different kinds of buffers might be more effective for nitrate nitrogen. And he even worked with a modeler. He worked with Chip Cheshire, and they looked at some data, a couple different models, and they modeled it over a 20-year period, and these were the data they came up with, that nitrate, phosphorus, and TKN were reduced by about 80% over a 20-year period, and sediment by about 92%. Now, one of the things that kept Wendell busy, besides all these research projects that he was involved in, were his state committees. These aren't all the committees he served on. These are just the ones I thought were most interesting and that I'd show you. Now, the one adverb that does not pertain to Wendell is shy. And so he was vocal in these committees, which is critically important. I also know he testified to our state legislators a number of times. A couple of the committees to note are the Sediment Control Commission, the North Carolina Water Quality Advisory Committee, the North Carolina Division of Water Quality Best Management Practice Advisory Committee, this was an important committee, and the Neuse River Water Quality Working Group. You also heard mention that he worked on a number of state bills that passed. I would contend, and he will probably tell me either now or later if I'm right or wrong, but I think as far as implementing riparian buffers in the state of North Carolina, probably the committee that he served on that had the biggest impact was the Neuse River Water Quality Working Group, and he'll tell us whether that's true later. Let me tell you a little bit about how Wendell had his impact. In the mid-1990s, we had major fish kills in the Neuse Estuary. They also discovered Fisteria, and so there was a lot of hysteria about that. And the group that passes our environmental regulation, the Environmental Management Commission, said, we've got to do something. And so the aquatic scientists said, well, you can fix the problem by reducing nitrogen by 30%. The Division of Water Quality put together a set of rules, but they talked to Wendell a lot as they were putting these rules together. They're an equal opportunity control agency. They wanted to deal with the point source folks, they wanted to deal with the urban non-point source folks, and they wanted to deal with the agricultural folks. But Wendell got in there, and one of the things he said is you need to implement buffers. They're the most important BMP, regardless of whether it's urban or ag. Now, Peter alluded to this already. Wendell did a really smart thing before the buffer regulation was finalized. He got together this working group. He invited a number of outside scientists Dr. Lawrence was there. Dr. Correll was there. We had bio and ag engineering there. We had soil science there. Importantly, he invited the regulators, the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, particularly the Division of Water Quality. Those were the folks making the rules. Farm Bureau was there to represent the ag community, and NRCS was there. And for 2 days, we walked around in different buffer sites, and I got to see Wayne Skaggs and Wendell Gilliam argue. They argued all the time. We'd go to a site and they'd argue, and we'd go to another site and we'd argue. And you guys were bigger than each other. The whole was bigger than the two of you. It was fascinating watching them work together. And as a result of those discussions, we had a one-day meeting, and there were some recommendations that we suggested, and the Division of Water Quality took many of those recommendations that came out of this working group. The first thing that was recommended is that if you're on an upland buffer with either an incised stream or a ditch channel and you have no field erosion, 50-foot tree buffer is okay, or if you'd rather, a 25-foot tree buffer and a 25-foot grass buffer. Either way, doesn't matter. However, if you've got a soil erosion problem, you need a 25-foot tree buffer and a 25-foot grass buffer. That's to get the surface pollutants that are coming off. Now, we have a lot of our agricultural in the lower coastal plain. Wayne already talked about that. And the recommendation for riparian buffers in that lower coastal plain position with hydric soils is either 25 feet of trees or 25 feet of grass. Knowing that the farmers will never plant trees, so we'll be real happy if we can get 25 feet of grass. And last but not least, if you have a pasture, regardless of its landscape position, fence the cows out 25 feet, either 25 feet of trees or 25 feet of grass. Now, when we talk about vegetative cover, we're usually talking about non-point source pollution because, I mean, we recognize, and in one of the books that we publish, we talk about the other benefits of trees as far as temperature control, holding stream banks together. But one of the things that came out of this meeting was actually the Noose book that Peter showed, and then this follow-on book that dealt with all the river basins in North Carolina. So it was taking science and making recommendations. Now, I could spend the rest of my talk talking on riparian buffer rules in the Neuse River Basin, and I am not going to bore you all. So I'm going to give you kind of the really condensed three-sentence version. Basically, if you've got a riparian buffer in the Neuse River Basin, you have to leave it. At least 50 feet, you have to leave. In the first 20 or 30 feet of all, you can log selectively, and then the next 20 feet or so, you can log however you want, and then we want a grass buffer. I would argue that the riparian buffer regulation, as it got implemented, was far more important for the urban areas than the ag areas, because it's already been alluded to that basically when we have riparian buffers in our ag lands, it's because the soil, we have hydric soils that are too wet to farm. But in a lot of the urban areas, as they were developing, the developers were pulling down those buffers as fast as they could. And our Division of Water Quality has a great map, which they have yet to send me. I'd love to get a copy. It shows what development would look like without the riparian buffer rule, and you would see huge amounts of riparian buffers in urban areas wiped out, and a lot of the streams put under culverts. But because the buffer rules are in effect in the Neuse River Basin, we've really protected a lot of urban streams. And that's directly contributable to the way Wendell argued to protect riparian buffers. Now, for those of you that have been listening to all the things, the research activities that Wendell did, you'll see his fingerprints all over this slide. These are the mandatory agricultural practices that were implemented for the Neuse River Basin. 50-foot riparian buffers, that's just what he recommended. Nutrient management and a 20-foot forested riparian buffer, or nutrient management and a 30-foot vegetated buffer, or nutrient management and controlled drainage. These are the best management practices that Wendell talked to the Division of Water Quality about, and this is the way the Division of Water Quality implemented the rules. Now, Farm Bureau argued that it would be impossible for all of our producers to implement these mandatory best management practices. Could you please give the farmers some relief? Let them choose the practices where the practices they want and where they want to put them. And so the NUSE rules got rewritten a little bit for agriculture. Rather than having absolute mandatory best management practices, basically we got this local option which said the farmers can band together, but they have to show they have a 30% nitrogen reduction using a tracking tool which is yet to be developed, but I'm sure somebody will develop it. And I want to talk about how important Wendell was as we developed this nitrogen tracking tool. We couldn't have done it without him. So this is the nitrogen tracking tool that we use in the Neuse River Basin. I'll talk about some other basins it's used in. Rather than having to put on the mandatory best management practices, the farmers in each county have this tool used for them by the Division of Water Quality. And basically it tracks reductions in nitrogen through fertilizer use, best management practices, and in particular I want to talk about riparian buffers. We went to Wendell and we said, Wendell, we need your best estimates of how well riparian buffers reduce nitrogen. And so as we were talking, he said, well, if you have a 50-foot tree and grass buffer, you should give it 95% reduction. And we had somebody that was a little nervous. He said, well, maybe not 95% in all places. Maybe go to 85%. And Wendell said, yeah, that's reasonable. Let's go with that. Well, we needed to know what a 20-foot tree or shrub buffer would look like because that was part of the NUSE rules. And so Wendell talked to us about it. And again, these aren't based completely on research. I mean, some of these are scientific best professional judgments. But you have to make them in a regulated situation. And Wendell was in there helping us make these decisions. And so for a 30-foot vegetative buffer, we had a 65% reduction. Without his data, without his expertise, we could not have developed this tool. Now, not only do we have riparian buffer regulations in the Neuse River Basin, but we have a lot of nutrient-sensitive waters. Our Division of Water Quality liked the Neuse rules so well that they said, we're going to take the same rules and we're going to implement them in the Tarr-Pamlico River Basin. So we have buffer rules in the Tarr-Pamlico River Basin. We have agricultural rules in the Tarr-Pamlico River Basin. They also said we want to protect the Catawba River Basin. It's the one right here. And we have mandatory riparian buffer rules. They are absolutely identical to the NUSE. They're the rules that basically Wendell helped craft. And last but not least, we have another river basin where we're probably going to have some rules implemented. And again, they're going to be very similar to the NUSE, and it was Wendell's work that got these rules passed the way they were. Now, I want to just briefly talk about some current work that he started, and then as he was phasing out, some of the rest of us continued, and how it's impacted some recent decisions we've made. This work was done by Tim Smith. He's in the back of the room, so if you have any questions, you can direct it to him. Wayne and Wendell worked in Duplin County. I want to talk a little bit about this particular site. There was a stream running through a field. On this side was a spray field, so Hog Lagoon affluent and Hog Lagoon affluent. There was what I call a remnant buffer. There were large trees, and the reason the trees were there was it was just too wet to farm. The old buffer was about 9 meters, and over the course of a couple years, Wayne and Wendell took water samples, and they saw that the buffer was quite effective, but they also saw that the stream nitrate nitrogen concentrations were still pretty high. They were over 5 milligrams per liter. So Wendell talked to the landowners and he said, you know, I think what you need to do is get a wider buffer. And so they expanded this buffer to 30 meters. So you have the 9-meter buffer with these large trees, and then you have this newer buffer where nothing was done for about 9 years, maybe 8 years. And then we came back and we started sampling. So in this this extended buffer area, we had saplings that had been growing for about 8 years, and then the management came by every year and mowed right along the fence line. So we had three different buffer types. We had kind of a grassy buffer along the fence, then all these saplings, and then these big trees. And Tim looked at the groundwater. He had a well nest that had three different depths, and he had two different transects. And I don't want to belabor this. I just want to show you what happened. By shallow well, I mean the shallow well in the aquifer above the aquitard. And by deep well, I mean the deeper well in the aquifer above the aquitard. And so on the east side, when the buffer was only 9 meters, we had about a 35% reduction. Something I forgot to mention. The nitrate nitrogen concentrations under these spray fields were running about 60 to 70 milligrams per liter of nitrate nitrogen. Now, Wendell has a rule of thumb. He has lots of rules of thumbs. But one of his rule of thumbs is if you want to know how many pounds of nitrogen that is, just double it, okay? So we were looking at about 120 pounds of nitrate nitrogen under these spray fields. Really large as compared to the 20 to 40 pounds of nitrate nitrogen that we see under commercially fertilized fields. So when the buffer was 9 meters, we got about a 35% reduction. After widening the buffer to 30 meters, we got a 95% reduction. And there was a significant difference between these two buffer widths. On the west side of the stream, we went from a 53% reduction at 9 meters to almost a 95% reduction at 30 meters. Although they weren't statistically different, I'll take the 93% any day. And you can also see that there were some slight increases in dissolved organic carbon. For these, what I call shallow deep wells, the story was a little bit different. On the east side of the stream, with the 9 meter buffer, it was actually loading 40% nitrogen, whereas after the buffer was widened, we got this reduction of almost 40%. And you can see there was a significant difference with width. But if you look at the east in the shallow deep versus the east shallow, we got much better reduction in the shallow system than we did in the deep. When you look at the west side, you'll see that the results weren't nearly as promising. At the 9 meter buffer, you had about a 20% reduction. 30 meter buffer, we actually had some loading. The bottom line was the buffer was helpful. The surface water quality was much better. The problem with this particular situation is that the buffer's working great, the buffer's working hard, the buffer can never, ever replace good nutrient management. You know, this is a case where Wendell would say you got to have combined best management practices. And this is an experiment that was started by Wendell and Robert Evans. It's at the Center for Environmental Farming Systems. Scott King did his master's work here. And I want to talk a little bit about this briefly again. The thing about this particular study is they started from scratch. There were no buffers, so they put buffer treatments on. They had a tree buffer system, and although this looks primarily pine, and it is primarily pine at this point, it was planted both to pines and hardwoods. There was a fescue buffer. There was a buffer they just let regenerate. Whatever vegetation came up. There was a switchgrass buffer, and then there was a control. And sometimes the control was an agricultural field like corn, and sometimes it was a pasture situation. And Scott is also sitting in the back of the room, so questions can be directed to him. We had two buffer widths, 8 meter and 15 meter. We had these five vegetative types, if you include the control as a vegetative type, and we had four reps. So this was actually a replicated buffer study from scratch. Trees, fescue, switchgrass, native. You can see the field edge wells, the ditch edge wells, and the nitrate nitrogen reduction. And although this looks promising that the trees are better than the fescue, switchgrass, and native, when Scott ran his statistics, unfortunately, there's no significant difference because the data are so messy. So there's no significant difference due to vegetation, due to buffer width, or due to groundwater depth. But there are definite trends. The trees are a little bit better. The wider buffer is a little bit better. and the deeper groundwater in this system is better than the shallow groundwater because it's a more upland site. These are not hydric soils. So what's our current thinking? And I think this represents the whole body of knowledge that Wendell has helped develop over the past 35 years. Vegetative type is obviously really important at reducing surface transport of pollutants. That's why he recommends a grass buffer first and then a tree buffer. Our data are less conclusive that vegetative type is as important for reducing subsurface nitrogen. And so we're not as convinced that vegetative type is as important as it is for surface. Width has some effect, but it's highly mediated by the pollutant load that's coming in, the landscape position, the hydrology, and the soils. And last but not least, net nitrate reduction, I don't know how well you can see that, is lower than measured nitrate removal. And I'm just going to spend a minute talking about that. Now, we may have gotten what I'm about to say wrong. Wendell was in on our discussion, and without his blessings, we would not have gone forward with this concept. The Division of Water Quality kept saying, what's the net nitrate reduction? That is, if you have a buffer next to a stream versus a crop next to the stream, what is the reduction? And remember, we have data from the CEF site for trees, switchgrass, fescue, and native, along with our control. So we knew what the buffer nitrate reduction was for these different buffer types, but we also knew what the crop nitrate reduction was. If you, go back here, we had this value. We knew what the percent nitrogen reduction effectiveness of these controls were. And so when we did the subtraction, we found that the net nitrate reduction for this site, when a graduate student by the name of Dukes worked on it from 1998 to 2000, ranged from 14% to actually loading 2%. Now, when Scott worked on this site about 5 years later, we were able to produce the same results. And you can see that the trend is, as these systems have had longer to mature, the trend is that they're doing a better job of reducing nitrate than they were when the vegetation was originally planted. But again, the net nitrate reduction ranged from 30% to 10%. Another student worked at this site in 2000-2001. He worked on some, he used different reps than Dukes used. He saw 16 to 1% net nitrate reduction. And so Scott compared his results for the reps that Rick's looked at and saw a 29 to 6% net nitrate reduction. We took these values and we went and we put them in the nitrogen loss estimation worksheet. Again, this is the tracking tool we use in the Neuse River Basin. And we changed our recommendations. We no longer consider vegetative type to be as important. We're simply looking at buffer width. And now we're saying that the net nitrogen reduction for, let's use the 50-foot buffer width is 50%. Originally we had 85%, we've now dropped it by 35%. And so we've lowered our expectations for how well these buffers work. These numbers aren't exactly what we saw here. I mean, the highest we ever saw in our net nitrate reduction was 30%. But we have these numbers a little higher because we're not sure. We don't have the confidence that this should actually be maybe 15% and this should be 20%. We're giving the buffers the benefit of the doubt based on other experimental work. And so the work that Wendell has done has continued to play in the policy decisions in the state of North Carolina. Over 30% of our state has mandatory riparian buffer rules. And they were all due to the work that Wendell's done over the years. Now, these are some graduate students he has on a field trip. Is he freezing? No, it's the graduate students that are freezing. he was a good mentor to graduate students. And the thing that I also want to say is he was a good mentor to those of us that started on the faculty. I've had lots of help in my career. I appreciate all the help the many, many faculty gave me. But the person who mentored me the most was Wendell, and I greatly appreciate that mentoring. You weren't my formal mentor, but you were my informal mentor. And so I want to thank Wendell a lot. And I think those of us that are here, the reason we're here is we're here to thank Wendell. So I, on behalf of the audience, Wendell, I would like to thank you.